When I moved to Melbourne more than 30 years ago now, my local friend took me to Pellegrini's for coffee. It was home of the Melbourne establishment, he explained. Not that clubby establishment, but something closer to the aesthetic heart of the city. The cafe's co-owner, Sisto Malaspina, was killed on November 9 in a terror attack stabbing, and something in the essence of the city died with him. I'm Jonathan Green. This is Blueprint for Living, the last half hour. This week, Pellegrini's. Sisto Malaspina spoke to Carl Williams in 2003 for RN's Verbatim.
Here we give you modern food. This is your home away from home.
Okay.
That's what it is. But it's Pellegrini's. My name is Sisto, as already have been introduced. I was born in Italy, in a little town by the Adriatic, central North Italy on the east coast. And I came to Australia almost 40 years ago when I was just turned 18.
Yeah.
And I'm still here. Melbourne has always had a feel of a place where you enjoy being. But that's funny. I only remember the best things that happened to me. But I've got beautiful memories of Melbourne as a young man because I never felt that I was in the wrong place. I always felt that I was at the right place.
The place is just about the cheapest meal in Melbourne. You can still hang out on a single coffee and read the London Review of Books without being shooed away. It's the very essence of a cafe, the tavern, taverna, table. There in the Sumerian cities 4,000 years ago, before Rome, before Greece, before Abraham, before God. When such things die, cities die too. Those who commit to their one place, on one corner, gird the city more than any concrete piles and tunnels currently being driven into it. Guy Rundle.
So I remember in summer, because we arrived in spring in summer, somebody said, let's go and have a gelati. And we came to Pellegrini's for a gelati. There weren't very many cafes. Pellegrini's was one of the few established ones. But I do remember going to a few cafes. You had a smaller choice. The quality of the coffees, well, it didn't worry me then. I wasn't a coffee connoisseur. Mm. You have a few old men sitting in the front playing whatever game of cards, and people didn't perhaps feel comfortable to go in. But that didn't offer very much other than the coffee and a few stale cakes, really, a few bread rolls. So people didn't have a reason to go there. And, well, it's like Pellegrini's, reputed to be the first cafe in Melbourne. It wasn't, but it was the first one to do the coffees, the cappuccino, properly, the way it should have been done all along. The cakes were made here, baked on the premises, of very high standard, so there wasn't many cafes as such where you go and have a coffee, have a bowl of pasta, and have a homemade gelati, homemade cake. So they, in such a little space, they combined the best of few things. And so therefore, you are judged by your standard, really. And so if people remember Pellegrini's as the first one, obviously, that was the one to do it correctly.
Yeah, the first good one.
The first good one, yes, that's the word. When the Pellegrini's boys opened in 1954, they went to this gentleman that had started already, had a coffee roasting company. He said, look, we want something very special. We want, to use an old cliche, Rolls Royce of the coffees.
Yeah.
You know, I want something smooth, something with a body, something pleasant. And so come up with this blend. The boys tasted it, they thought it was terrific. I said, okay, let's call it Brasil Rex. Rex means king in Latin, so king from Brazil. And we're still using the same blend after 49 years. Don't ask me how it's been blended, because nobody would tell. They keep the secrets really closely. It's like Coca-Cola, I mean, I ask them for their recipe. We are fortunate that we are in Melbourne, and that we have people that are connoisseurs of coffees, because there's so many cafes of so many different backgrounds. And also the water in Melbourne is very good. Now, water is a very, very important part of the coffee making. In 1974, Pellegrini's was as popular as it is now, if not more popular, because there were nowhere else to go. It was Florentino Pellegrini's and a few others of Chinatown. But the thing that amazes me, that now there are restaurants in every corner of the streets, in every suburbs, regardless whether you got north, east, west or south, there are cafes everywhere, and Pellegrini's is just as busy.
Professor Andrew May is a social historian at the University of Melbourne. He's the author of Espresso, Melbourne Coffee Stories. Andrew, take us back to inner Melbourne of the mid-1950s, apparently a place where a coffee machine could be socially transformative.
I think it's really hard, Jonathan, for us to imagine what the 1950s was like. And part of what I have tried to do is sort of read history forwards, if you like. And if we plonk ourselves down in Melbourne of the early 1950s, very different place, obviously, from the city of today. Coming off, you know, decades from the Depression and the war, things just starting to modernise, but still a fairly kind of drab and conservative place. And we saw at that period the demolition of a lot of wonderful old architecture. We still had a 6 o'clock swill where hotels were closing at 6 p.m. And we had a very different inner city as well. And I think that's a big difference between then and now. The city now, with the revitalization through the latter decades of the 20th century, is a really incredibly vibrant, dense, multicultural, diverse place. But in the 50s, it was still pretty dead at night. We just started to get the growth of suburban expansion in that post-war period. So the city was on the cusp of something. Something was going to happen, and coffee played a role in that.
You mentioned multicultural there. I mean, how much is the change that's about to take place? How much is that driven by migrant communities?
The coffee story is a really interesting one to get our heads around this. And it's not that we're saying that in the pre-war period even, that there weren't cafes, for example, in the city where you could get European-inspired food. And there were obviously previous generations of smaller but nonetheless significant minorities of European immigrants. And we had places like Fasoli's in Lonsdale Street, Cafe Petrushka. These were places where you could go and get that kind of European experience. But it was the heyday of the tea room. We drank, you know, 10 times more tea than coffee in the very British in the pre-war period. But there was a bit of a taste for coffee. There were a few little chains. There was a well-known one called Gibby's that had started in the 1930s. And then a few things happen which link to multiculturalism, but it's not just about multiculturalism. And like any good sort of social or cultural change, it's multifactorial. We have the Americans in Melbourne in the Second World War, the American military based here, and they were big coffee drinkers. And they quite frankly thought that the coffee in Melbourne was pretty ordinary, sort of very boiled, stewed kind of coffee that we used to drink. So they actually imported their own roasting and grinding and packaging machinery. And that actually had, in itself, had a bit of an influence on coffee drinking in the city. But it's a technological breakthrough when Gaggia, a bar owner in Milan, invents the, let's call it the lever machine, that listeners will be familiar with, the spring lever mechanism, that forces water, hot water, at a controllable level through the grounds, not as steam, but as just warm water under boiling point. 1947, that's the radical sort of breakthrough. And so what we then get is this new coffee with the beautiful crema on the top, and it's not bitter like the old sort of boiled coffee machines in the pre-war period. And then we get this from London. London is another important place. So in the early 1950s, when post-war restrictions on everything Italian had been lifted, there's a bit of a kind of an Italian, you know, revival. We've got Gina Lollobrigida, we've got Italian film festivals, we've got important places like the Mocha Bar in Soho, Il Cappuccino in Hanover Square. And it just so happens that there's a young Melburnian, who's not Italian, his name is Peter Bancroft, from a Jewish family. His father, Harry, ran a dry cleaning business. Peter happened to be in London in the early 50s, very entrepreneurial young lad, and he secured the sole agency to import Gaggia machines to Australia. So the first and one of the challenges of and inspirations of my book was to try and track down this urban folklore. Who had the first espresso coffee machine in Melbourne? We know there are lots of wonderful cafes still from that period. Well, in fact, it was the Bancrofts who opened a little place called Il Cappuccino, misspelt with one P, which is interesting in itself, in Fitzroy Street in St Kilda in 1954. And then very quickly they sold machines to University Cafe, Don Camillo's, and Pellegrini's and others. So, you know, that's not an Italian influence. It's partly about the technology and the entrepreneurialism of a businessman. When I did the book, I had interviewed many people in the 1990s, many of whom have passed on. And I spoke to Italian, you know, guys who'd got off the ship in the early 1950s, never tasted espresso coffee in Italy. You know, so this notion that, you know, the Italians are the kind of zero point, yes, we had families who'd come over, important people who'd had experience in the coffee trade, and who set up a lot of those early companies like Mocapan and Crivelli, the Crivelli family, the Dimatinas, and so on. Very, very important, but not all Italians were kind of into it. Wonderful stories of immigrants going to Pellegrini, sitting down at the bar, watching this newfangled machine making coffee, and then thinking, great, I'll set up a cafe of my own. So that's where we get this sort of spread of espresso bars, not just in Melbourne, but down in Moorabool Street in Geelong and elsewhere. So it's a fascinating story.
Andrew May is a social historian.
Everyone who came into town for a movie, in the days when you came into town for a movie, sooner or later wandered in, tried for a counter seat, and accepted an elbow-crowding wall space. Even today, people wander in, down from a show at the exhibition buildings, or here to see the laneways, gawp a little at its retro styling, settle nervously on the stools, and get the same rapidamente treatment. Guy Rundle.
Cappuccino was the standard way coffee. Then the latte society came along, and there was just a latte, you know, the number one on the chart, followed by a cappuccino. The espresso is maybe fourth or fifth, because then you got the long black, so three. Yeah, the espresso is the number four on the chart. But for every 5 or 6, maybe 10, there is Irish Stretto. In Italy, they got funny ways of doing things, and they think they are the Bible. You know, you drink caffè latte in the morning, cappuccino maybe late morning, espresso the rest of the day. And I do not subscribe to that. I think people should drink their coffees how they like it, the way they like it, when they like it. So I haven't got a problem with someone wanting a cappuccino after dinner. For the Italians, would be almost unthinkable. And don't worry, I've had a bit of a bit to say when I travel through Italy and I go somewhere and I want a long black. They just don't have to make a long black coffee. It should not be difficult to make a long black the way the rest of the world has it. When we started here, I mean, it was a fairly well-established place, so I credit myself as a very, very good caretaker. And if you look at Pellegrini's, it's unique in a way. We have a lot of unusual things on the shelves and whatever. Well, they are there to make people relax. The moment they walk out of the office, but they come into Pellegrini's, they have to forget about the problems of the office, the computer, the telephones, the mobile. They have to pretend they are in a different part of the world. Totally different. Doesn't essentially have to be Italy. It can be Alice Springs, perhaps. Only on Friday, one of my, should I say, favorite customers, a gentleman from the top end of Collins Street, said to me, you know, this coffee is great, because he has a long macchiato, but we do it with a froth, we do it nicely. Coffee break isn't just food to your stomach. It is for the soul, for your mind, for the eyes. And he said to me, do you know how long it's taken me to get to enjoy your coffee? He said, so that shouldn't be telling you. He said, but I was coming here, he said, more for the experience than the coffee itself. Not because there was something wrong with your coffee. He said, I never used to drink coffee. I still like my Vegemite sandwich very much. To run a cafe, you've got to be naturally generous in your way of your smile, not too much, just enough. But not because you feel that you have to. It should be there as a nature when you see people. But not because they refill your till, but because they patronize you and they enjoy what you're doing for them. And also, if you give them generous meal, now you go somewhere and they give you a little bit of pasta, a little bit of, you go home, you're still hungry. Come on, a little bit extra doesn't cost that much. You know, an extra 50 cents, an extra 20 cents, you feed the person. And so you got to be generous. My father used to always say, always, you must give before you take. And it is always better to be charitable than be charitable upon. Always. And never forget a few of the little things. And the one should be so lucky to be able to give.
Sooner or later, someone on the right, who's been quiet on this aspect, will crack, and reading the Twitter tributes of Arterate, celebs and pollies, sneer about latte lovies. They'll be correct in saying that millions of Melburnians have never heard of Pellegrini's, but they'll be wrong about the place's reach over half a century, through the decades before the 90s, when its neon blazed at the dark end of a quiet street, in a city at the southern end of the world. Guy Rundle.
Dr. Nanette Carter is a senior lecturer in the School of Design at Swinburne University. Nanette, take us back to 1954 when Pellegrini's opened. It must have made quite a design statement.
Absolutely, but I think it was a forerunner of a kind of stream of new Italian and Greek cafes throughout Melbourne and other capital cities around Australia. I think that Pellegrini's is remarkable because of its mixture of modernist design, and it also has elements of sort of standard Italian cafe decor, things like the timber lining, often timber's quite prominent, use of brass. Also, mosaic tiles are there in Pellegrini's. You get their lovely sort of ultramarine mosaic tiles used on the column near the entrance.
Take us through a little walk. I mean, here we walked, perhaps the exterior first, and then we'll pop inside.
Well, I think one of the things I love about the Italian cafes is often the signage. They often use really interesting, a mixture of either cursive or, more excitingly, with Pellegrini's on the front, we get the sort of modernistic typefaces. I say modernistic because they're sort of modern, but there's something sort of a bit quirky about them. And then, of course, Pellegrini's around the side has that fantastic cursive neon sign, which sort of slots it into a continuum of sort of cafe and restaurant design. In the 1930s, neon came in big time and was one of the things that you had to have if you were a halfway reasonable cafe.
So it's a very, very glass front.
Yes, a large plate glass front, very much large for the time.
And then we pop inside, and I guess the first thing you see is A, the counter, and B, that great big machine, the espresso machine there sitting behind.
Yes, absolutely, and very impressive. Up until the post-war period, tended to be sort of stove-top espresso was used in restaurants and cafes, but so in the post-war we get the sort of importation, and Pellegrini is arguably the first, but certainly one of the first three probably in Melbourne.
Which is quite a thing. I mean, when you think about, I mean, this is the to take oneself back to that time from now is to encounter a city of such huge difference to the present. It's unimaginable the impact that place must have made.
Yes, exactly. And I think before that period, cafes tended to be very, or places to eat and socialise tend to be gendered. Like, we get men tending to meet at pubs, even if they didn't drink, that was a place men went to meet other men and you know, have a chat and so on, whereas women tended to go to tea rooms. And so, you know, women, a lot of women wouldn't, most women probably wouldn't be seen in a pub unless they're accompanied by a man. So it was very separated, where with you get the introduction in the 30s with the milk bars, where it was sort of a space that men and women could go and hang out, particularly young men and women. And I think very much the Italian cafes of the 50s and 60s played that role as well.
Well, suddenly here we have La Dolce Vita and the gender mixing possibilities of coffee, pasta and fruit cup.
Absolutely, and a granita.
It's an extraordinary interior. I mean, it's time-worn now, and yet still has the dignity of really good design.
Absolutely. I think that there's this really interesting mix where it's modern, but it's comfortable, it's homely, but it's smart. And also there's interesting materials. And also that it sort of foregrounds the people in it. I think they're not really loud in terms of bright colours and too many textures and a lot going on. They create a background for the people and the clothes they're wearing and those sorts of things.
And it's interesting, the design of cafes in many Australian cities, I mean, it echoes some of these mid-century modern tropes, but that goes hand in hand with the migrant populations, the people who are building those places in our cities. It's the full package.
Yes, it is. And I think that was part of the experience too. It was a novelty for a lot of Anglo-Australians to go into a cafe and hear another language spoken and be exposed to different kinds of food and lots of different drinks and so on. So it was an exciting kind of event to go to one of those cafes.
And it's interesting that in design terms too, so many cafes in so many places, in cities and in regional Australia as well, have design of that period because everything is happening in that little bracket of years. So the design responds to that.
Yes, exactly. And it's very much that post-war period, large-scale migration, 3 million people coming to Australia. So it's had a huge effect on the Australian cultural and social scene.
Mid-century Australia transformed in a design sense, at any rate, by cafe culture. Nanette, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Nanette Carter. You've been listening to The Last Half Hour. This week, Pellegrini's, a small tribute to Sisto Malaspina, 1944-2018, and the life he brought. You heard Sisto, co-owner of Pellegrini's Cafe, Bourke Street, Melbourne. Dr. Nanette Carter, Senior Lecturer, School of Design, Swinburne University. Professor Andrew May, social historian at the University of Melbourne and author of Espresso, Melbourne Coffee Stories. And the words of Guy Rundle, read by Michelle Rayner. Producers were Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production, Christina Miltiadou. I'm Jonathan Green.